I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This is Meta, a podcast about podcasts, and I'm Peter Wells. And today I'm joined by Tim Ross, who has a new podcast out all about the tapestries that once hung in the Sydney Opera House. It was a show that was made in collaboration with the Sydney Opera House. It's called House Stories, and it really does highlight one of Tim's obsessions and also why he's one of my favourite comedians in Australia. There's a couple of swear words in this episode, not too many, I'd say maybe three all up, but they are it's the F word. I'm not going to lie. So if that kind of language is something you don't want to hear in front of your kids, then fair enough, don't listen to this one in front of them, but I think it'll be okay for most people. It's generally in context. Anyway, without any further ado, here is my conversation with Tim Ross. All right, well, thank you, Tim, for being here.
Pleasure.
Last time I saw you, Tim, it was at an antiques furniture store in Northcote in Melbourne. It was a benefit for the bushfires that had just kind of raged through the east coast of Australia. And I remember sitting there thinking, this year can't get any worse.
I think one of the things, the pure irony of that moment, within a week, I think, of doing that, I did a little bit of auctioneering for some friends who got a great restaurant in Sydney called Platenio, and they did a huge, huge benefit for the bushfires. And of course, you know, first people to rattle the can always are the performers. It's always the art. They're the first. And Hospo. And of course who would have thought that particularly for hospitality and certainly for some section of the art, that the shoe would have been on the other foot. It's been disappointing in some ways, I suppose, that some of the same thoughtfulness hasn't come back towards sections of the industry, of certain industries that always give time and money and whatever. So there's a sadness in that, I think, at the moment, particularly for the art, I think.
Absolutely. I think the community...
Deep misunderstanding.
Yeah, the community has been pretty supportive, I think, of both industries. It's just such a damn shame that so many industries are almost purposefully left out. I mean, I used to work in higher ed up until a couple of weeks ago. So, yeah, I know all about being ignored.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But, yeah, so, Tim, tell me about the new podcast, mate. I mean, I know that podcasts are the quintessential kind of niche market, but a podcast about... podcast about curtains hanging in an opera house. That's right up there.
Well, I say this, and I say, well, you know, when everyone goes, ooh, 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 well, don't be the person who tells me that I should watch a documentary about a fucking octopus. Because I don't reckon there's anything more niche than a man patting a fucking octopus. So, but it's a great example of a great story is a great story, despite what it is. And I'm a reasonably personally latecomer to podcasts. You know, a million years ago, in the very early days of podcasting, when I was still working in radio, I was fascinated by the opportunities, I suppose, as a broadcaster to do that, to be a little bit more niche, and had a quite bonkers podcast called Original Pirate Material, which I used to do in the old American Rosso days. And for a period of time, that was the number one podcast in the country. There wasn't many of them out there at the time, but I suppose the interesting thing was that I understood its potential straight away. But in recent times, I've been less interested because I love working live, because I've spent, in many ways, too much of my life behind a microphone. But this year changed all that because I couldn't do all the things I wanted to do, like doing those shows and funny little antique furniture stores and mid-century modern furniture stores. And so this is the first of a bunch of different projects that I've got up this year that are sort of digital based for that reason. And it happened pretty quickly when I watched all the things that I had planned disappear, a national tour for a live show and all sorts of other things. So I made contact with the Opera House, and I'd been invited to when they put the curtains, the tapestries, two of them, back on display, the John Coburn tapestries. And I own a John Coburn tapestry, so that sort of is part of the connection to tapestries. And as a person who is a nutty modernist, there's a strong tradition of tapestries making a resurgence. There was a resurgence in tapestries in the middle of the late 20th century. Architects loved them, and they tended to find a home in modernist buildings. Harry Seidler famously had a bunch of them in Sydney. So they do have that connection. I think everyone likes art in one way or another. But anyway, so I'm at there, and I saw them there, and I heard the story, and it always stuck in the back of my mind. I thought, you know what? This is a good story. You know, how these two tapestries commissioned for the Opera House, great Australian artist, takes his family to France. They have a fantastic time there, formative. Incredibly romantic experience, I think, for a bunch of Australian kids from the northern beaches to go to France in the late 1960s as teenagers while their dad's an artist. And so that appealed to me as a father with young kids, the romance of doing that. And then the curtains were made, and then they were incredibly popular, but they were taken down because some of the arts groups didn't really appreciate them in some ways. They thought they clashed with the performances. So I thought, this is a great story. You know, first week of lockdown, pretty much hit up the Opera House, and they say yes. And so that's why we're here today. So it took a while for us to get into putting them all together. But there's four tapestries in the Opera House, and two of them by John Coburn, one by Le Corbusier, and the other one by Jan Utzon. So they've all got wonderful stories, and they all represent something great about the Opera House. And it's sort of, I'm sort of obsessed. I'm sort of obsessed with the Opera House in some way. We can't get sick of it. Can't get bored of it. It never fails to impress. And being someone who's been lucky enough to perform there a couple of times, it's certainly out of my skin.
Yeah, it's a fascinating building because, obviously that goes without saying, but the fact that it is still almost under construction, you know, we're still finding things that were in the original plans that were never seen through. You know, what is it about this building that a tapestry can be specifically designed for this space and then yanked down? That just blows my mind.
Yeah, and I think there's something about the building that just stirs up controversy and all the time, and it disappoints people associated with it in some ways. You know, it's broken a bunch of people's hearts, and I think that's fascinating because, and then it's made a bunch of people really, really happy. And the building evolves, constantly evolves, and it will be around for hundreds of years. And the way that we see theatre will change in some ways, and it will adapt, and it will adapt well, and it will still have huge shells. But in 200 years, what it looks like inside could be once again something completely different as well, bigger, smaller. Who knows? But it will certainly survive unless someone drops a bomb on it. And so it's an incredibly important building for us. And the idea that we could put something in there that was beautiful, and the Coburn tapestries were used in terms of marketing the building. They became synonymous with sales in some ways in those early days. And all those people, I wasn't there, but all those people who saw them in situ when they were a kid or whenever they went, everyone loved it. The idea that there's a big explosion of colour when you come into the Opera House to get you ready for the performance. And they certainly did that, but it's been a while. You know, my knowledge of Australian theatre is pretty limited, apart from some of my studies in drama at La Trobe University. But I think that I get it, that the styles of theatre weren't exactly... The idea of a curtain was not something that was popular with theatre in the modern period, I suppose. So, you know, the idea of going to see a play and the curtains open and things happen is a very old-fashioned one, and certainly wasn't, you know, and we've all been to plays where you walked in there and then there's a scrim and there's people frozen on stage or sitting on a beanbag or doing something or other. So, you know.
One empty chair and, yeah.
yeah, didn't need curtains or whatever. So, yeah, and they're so big, it's hard to put them anywhere else.
Yeah.
It's huge, huge, huge.
Well, I'm glad that. So are they actually going to get back to their rightful place, or
they're impossible to use? Tapestries are great for hanging, but not so great for moving. And so, They don't work particularly well if you have to move them all the time. So they could just be hanging somewhere. So that's one of the reasons that they're not particularly practical. They're not fit for purpose in some ways. And the major problem is that they don't fit anymore, even if they did want to use them.
Right, right.
They don't fit in the theatres, in the way the theatres have changed. And so there's also the conservation part of it, is how long can they survive for if you continue to use them in that way? How long do we keep them and how do people see them? So the way that if they keep bringing them out once every 2 years and putting them up, they'll survive for 1,000 years. But the interesting thing about how we conserve things is that what do we go hell for leather and let everyone see them for a shorter period of time, or do we ration it out? Mm-hmm. At some stage, sooner or later, they will turn to dust. We can delay that. So that's a challenge. And I think it'd be great for them to have a sort of purpose-built sort of
space,
theater or something. There was some sort of museum or gallery for them, but that's unlikely to happen. And there's not enough. There's not a space not to hang them in the theater because of the size. You can't hang them anywhere else in the building.
Yeah,
But people deserve to see them, I think.
Yeah.
Because they're amazing.
I'd love to see something like the Powerhouse Museum having a dedicated wing to this kind of thing. If you go to MoMA or something like that in New York, they've got whole floors dedicated to modern architecture and modern design. And the Powerhouse has a little bit of that. It has some of the icons that you've used in your stage plays over the years, the cafe bar.
Yeah, the cafe bar and the stack at. Mm. Funnily enough, where I'm talking to you right now is the shared office my wife and I have in Nelson Design in Sydney. We sublet the space off them because they don't need they're industrial designers, and it's actually in where I'm sitting now is where they designed the cafe bar.
Yeah, right.
They're the first model to put together.
Amazing.
So there we go. But it's also where they did the first prototypes of the pedestrian button. But yeah, so I think you're right. I think that somewhere like the Powerhouse Museum would be fantastic for it. And those moments of simple moments. That's a sort of a broad, huge brushstroke of Australian history in terms of something as remarkable as a tapestry as these pieces of art, but are as important as things like the first stack hats, which speaking about disintegrating, so the white stack hat in its box that's in the Powerhouse Museum, that they haven't put it in the freezer like they've put the collection of Speedos.
Mm-hmm.
So all the Speedos, original Speedos, are frozen to stop them from disintegrating. They haven't done that, same thing in the stack hat. So I'm sure you remember the black foam inside the stack.
Picking out of your
material.
Hair. Yeah, when you got
home. Yeah, the material that goes, there's the foam and then there's a black material. All that's disintegrating in the stack hat. And so most people would say, oh, well, what does it matter? Well, you could say that about anything. The fact that you have to, like when I would be at the museum and I had to pick the stack hat up to use it for a photo shoot, I had to wear white gloves to pick up a stack hat, which is absurd. But, you know, ultimately, these are artifacts of the future.
Yeah.
And at some stage, people will look at them and go, God, what was that thing? What? So that was a stack hat. Look at a stack hat. It's the hat you wear if you have a stack. Bloody brilliant.
Have you seen the news that a Robin Boyd house in Melbourne is facing demolition at the moment?
Yeah. It's one of his, wasn't his first house to himself or something?
Yeah, the Woodhouse.
And it's not surprising. I think that one, if I remember rightly, the owners have just sort of been letting it sort of, demolition by neglect.
Yeah, right.
One of the oldest tricks in the book. Yeah, I would have thought we would, particularly in Melbourne, we would have got past this at the moment, but with the waters muddied so much by this year and the virus, I think trying to fight for heritage at the moment is the most impossible. I think it just seems trivial to most people.
And how do you even do it? I mean, you can't exactly.
Yeah, and how do you get people excited about saving something when they're worried about their jobs and the welfare of their loved ones and fear and other things sort of just loom a little bit larger in their lives. So I think it's a difficult time for heritage. We just got to get better at telling the stories and get better at reminding people why these things are important. Because it's not just one house, and one house becomes two houses, becomes five houses, and they're all gone. And in the future, we go, why do we do that?
Mm.
Well, why do we think that was okay? But, you know, greed always comes into play in this.
So 2020 must have been pretty devo. I've spoken to quite a few different comedians over the last couple of weeks and they all tell me the same story that, you know, they had this run of shows planned and then suddenly it was all taken away from them. How did you cope in those original couple of weeks when you started realizing?
It went pretty early for me. When I came home and had a bit of a cry, and then my wife said, stop crying.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a list of things. I thought, what can I do that doesn't involve me doing what I normally do? So, and I had a whole bunch of projects in my head, and I've got a funny little business anyway. And I always do weird things. So I just adapted a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we just ramped up what we do in terms of production. So I've got another podcast coming out that I've just finished for the National Gallery called Constant, which is about how Australian art can be a constant in our lives. So that was a great project as well. Actually, I love doing that. And a really experimental podcast in terms of thinking about it in terms of a digital exhibition rather than a podcast. So some of them are story based, some of them are interview based, some of them experiment based, but they're all interesting in one way or another and all. So I love doing that. So continuing my work with the National Archives. And so we're taking their certain images from their collection and turning them into film. So either making documentaries or just interpreting them in a different way. So that'll be an ongoing series. So yeah, anything where I didn't happen to have an audience, I just went for.
anything you could do with a Rode microphone and
it's my life has been about recording things, putting them in a Dropbox where it used to be about getting them. And so I've enjoyed the art of crafting audio, and you know I've been sort of I got an incredibly talented young guy working for me who I used to work with in the radio industry, and he can shoot and edit, and he also started off as an audio engineer, so he can do everything. And so poor bugger, he's been flat chat all year. So this look, I think there's two ways. If you aren't flexible, if you're not innovative as a performer, everything's always tricky.
Mm.
It's much easier. There's great pathways to audience. But if you, what I haven't spent much time investigating is replicating what I do in this space. I've been less interested in selling tickets to live events. I've been happy to wait it out and do different things. That may change as time goes on. I don't know. I'm prepared to investigate that. But I, it's not something that I think, as a performer, I find particularly compelling for myself. So I think if I don't love the idea of doing it, it's going to show in terms of how I would do it as a performer. So enough of us have been in enough shitty Zoom meetings over the last 6 months to realize it's fucking limitations of a performance tool.
Yeah.
So doesn't mean that those things that people have done and been happy to support them, but it just hasn't been for me.
Yeah, I think but, you know, you've got to embrace what the tools are.
Yeah,
and when you're living in a digital, like if your only tools left are digital tools, then yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense to throw in as much time and effort into that.
Yeah, and I think for me that was being able to make some films for different people, you know, a TV project that's finishing up, which has been, you know, a lifesaver as well. And in this time, not being a touring artist has been surprisingly pleasant in lots of ways.
Yep.
My family recognised me and that sort of tickled me. Yeah, I missed interaction. I got back on stage recently and I really enjoyed it. But, you know, like it is hard with a smaller crowd.
Yeah. I was going to ask about the family life when you're suddenly home a hell of a lot more than you expected.
I think I realised I was just away a lot more than I thought. I don't feel like I missed things, and it was good when I came back, but it's just been nice to be around a lot. And I was always around when I was back, but I might be away one day a week, and I never go on huge tours, you know, gentlemen's tours, we always call them, but there was always something on, you know, the reason to get on a plane to go and talk somewhere. The biggest change for me is that in the past I hadn't looked at those situations as things to take the family, because it didn't always make sense sort of financially for some of those things. But now I go, you know what, if I'm going to go somewhere, let's take the family, let's do all that together. That's the biggest change, because it has been, I feel quite blessed, to be honest, spending much time with the kids over the last few months.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
One question that comes up quite a bit in terms of architecture circles in Australia, I've always wanted to get your opinion on this, is the Sirius building. Now, I know, mm-hmm. I know you've been part of the Save Our Sirius, the movement there, but my personal opinion as someone who grew up in a housing commission is I want to save it, but I want to save it as fucking houses. I don't want rich people to be able to move in and get those amazing views. I want those views for the rest of time, or as long as that concrete stands, to be given to Housing Commission residents.
Yeah, I agree. And I think certainly as time progressed with my involvement, I think from early on when I started, it was the architecture that brought me to the party. And that's what I initially thought was important. And then, of course, the more time you spend and everything else that was going on in terms of the rocks in the area and basically taking a suburb where people had lived and grown up and moving them on, which wouldn't happen anywhere else in the world. It changed for me. It's not that I didn't, and I still do appreciate the architecture. Having it saved and then changed dramatically is better than it being bowled over. But it's a pretty ordinary consolation prize. And ultimately, to me, I'll echo what you say, which is that it is more important that we have its status as public housing than anything else on the architectural scheme. If my view changed in anything, was that it sadly represents a time where we cared. Mm. We cared about people less than we do today. And I think the fascinating thing about the rocks is that it was those initial houses and terrace houses were all built so people could be close to their family, so they could work long hours and they could come home and see their family. And so and that was 100 years ago. So we're actually more concerned then than today. And so there's a deep sadness to it on so many levels. And it just should be so much better. It worked perfectly. People loved it. It was not notorious for crime by any stretch of imagination. There was no sort of stigma to the building. You know, lots of people had grown up there and it was their home, and then it was no longer their home.
Yeah.
We should be better than that.
I totally agree. So are there any other, you've mentioned a couple of projects now, the art gallery working with the Sydney Opera House. Actually, on that, it must be pretty amazing to, like you say, throw a bit of audio in Dropbox. And then I would imagine it's quite different, the audio that you get sent back once audio engineers and sound designers and everyone else has had a chance to have a bit of a poke at it.
Well, I quite enjoyed the craft of it. It was one of the things I really liked about radio, actually. And particularly my last years in radio, as I found the limitations of the medium, and I'd been doing it for a while, and it was like, I like visuals, and so just speaking and audio was like, the reason I like architecture and art. And so trying to find ways to keep it exciting for me, because I refused to say, well, this is a job, I've been doing it for a long time, I'm bored of it. It was like, how can I find ways within this job to keep me challenged and interested? And so in the last couple of years, I worked really hard with a bunch of people I was working with in terms to craft really good, whether they were sketches or interviews or whatever it was, parody songs, dumb, silly, sophisticated or whatever, working on the sound design. So one of the things I noticed when I came to podcasting was that I had a reasonable skill base that I hadn't been using.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've interviewed a bunch of people over the years, so I can interview people okay, and I can string a story together pretty well. And I also know sound wise how to make things sort of sound good. So to jump around in that's pretty good. So I'm quite involved, and anytime I don't muck around with anything. And Ash, I work with, I said, "Oh, mate, I'm going to start editing." He goes, "Don't be stupid." You know, just tells me not to, because I was never technically that involved with stuff, because I'm of that generation of, you know, comedians who got into radio and someone else pushed the buttons and mm-hmm. that's expected. And if you learn how to do it, they'd make you do it. And so we just sort of avoided that. And people find that sort of quite bizarre and sort of charming, but I'm a relic from of another age. So there's sort of being quite tech savvy to a point, you know, do I need to do all those things? And he just said to me, he said, "Look, you know, you're much better at other things than wasting time chopping up interviews, and just, you know, just tell me what you want, how you want it to sound, and we'll put it together like that." So, yeah, and there'll be no hands on me, whatever it is.
Logic or, yep. Yeah, fair enough.
Garage Band, Adobe, blah, blah, whatever it is. I don't even know how it works. Same with editing. I can edit up some film clips for my kids. That's about it.
Yeah, fair enough. I still find myself dragged. Like, I've got a guy who polishes my stuff at the end, but I still end up finding myself editing, and I fucking hate it. But like, I hate doing it because I hate listening back to myself. But
yeah, that I think that's a tough thing as well.
Yeah. But there's something about the storytelling.
Yeah, I think that's the hardest thing. And I've also found that you know, I've done a few things where you're trying to present something together with someone else, and I found that really frustrating. Because it feels like radio to me. Then you're going, "Oh, we're both trying to tell a story, or we're both trying to facilitate something." Whereas, you know, sort of the one-on-one or narrative nature and of storytelling sort of quite interesting, or how you create radio plays soundscape is far more interesting than just three guys sitting around talking about what they had for dinner last night, which is, I'm too old for that, doing that shit.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Well, look, I feel I've taken a lot of your time, so we'll wrap it up in a second. I really can't. If there's anything else you want,
that's your sign. That's saying I'm boring you, Pete.
No, that is not true.
That's the point. He goes, "You wanted some magic. Tell some jokes, Beardy."
Hey, look. I've been to your live shows. I don't expect jokes from you.
Oh, bang. I mean, you know, it's occasionally it's like, "Oh, when are you gonna? Oh, you've turned into one of those. You got old and boring. Oh, yeah. Just, you know, it's like, oh, God. He's like a dad at the park who just talked to you about World War II. Go for it." Yeah, you know, like it's just when you let the nerdy shit take control. But thankfully, you know, the world's got that, you know, it echoes back to what we're talking about at the start about things being niche. It's allowed so many people to connect with other people. I've met so many people, amazing people, through being interested in architecture and design, which I would never have dreamed of. And in a far more meaningful way than people that I used to interview that were famous. And some of these people would be deemed as famous in their fields or well-known in some way. But because you've got a shared interest in something, the connection, the friendship bonds that are great, which is, I always think, you know, everyone laughs at literally the plane spotters and the train spotters. And they've known forever what's important in the world. They've had the secret forever. They've found what they like, and that's going to the airport on a Saturday with a whole bunch of other people who like going to the airport. And you go, "Oh, look, there's a fucking Boeing 747 coming in from Beirut. It's 3 minutes early. And they've changed the colouring of the plane." And I love that shit.
Mm.
And they're happy. And anyone who doesn't understand that or scoffs at them has misunderstood what's important in life, which is finding something you love and rolling around in it for as much as you can.
Absolutely.
For as long as you can.
I agree. And I will always think back with love to my stack hat. Because it did. It did save my head from quite a few bangs. Anyway, thank you so much for your time, mate. Yeah.
Good to chat, Pete. Thanks for reaching out, mate.
All good. All right. And I'll listen to a podcast about tapestry. Why not?
Good on you, buddy. Talk soon, all right? Cheers. Don't be a stranger.
Bye. Thanks to Tim Ross for joining me today. And thank you to Lauren Watson for the artwork. Thank you to James Smith for just being you. And thank you to everyone out in podcast listener land. If you can throw a couple of stars our way on Apple Podcasts, that would make a massive difference. Or just tell a friend that you found a new show called Meta that helps you find other shows that you love. My name is Peter Wells. I'll speak to you next week. Bye.